down his nose at the same time. Most glad to welcome you to Port Roger. Hope that your quarters are convenient. His English is almost perfect except for a slight inflection. And now he glances down his nose and smiles as he gestures towards a table 20 feet long, laden with food, fish, oysters, shrimp, turkey, venison, wild pig, heaping bowls of rice, yams, corn, mangoes, oranges, and kegs of wine and beer. Chacun pour soi. Everyone helps himself as Skipper Nordenhals indicates the seating arrangements. I am to sit at his table with Captain Strobe, the De Fuentes or Iguana twins as they are called, Opium Jones, Bird Hansen, Clinch Todd, Hans, and Kelly, and a Dr. Benway. I will attempt to report as accurately as my memory permits the conversation at the dinner table. It was all concerned with weaponry and tactics, but on a level I had never thought possible outside my lonely adolescent literary endeavors, for I have always been a scribbler, and during the long shut-in winters filled notebook after notebook with lurid tales involving pirates from other planets, copulations with alien beings, and attacks of the Radiant Boys on the Citadel of the Inquisition. These notebooks with illustrations by Bert Hansen are in my possession, locked in a small chest. The conversation at the dinner table gave me the feeling that my notebooks were coming alive. For the benefit of you great white boys, Skipper Nordenhals looked down at the table and his eyes glinted with irony. I would like to say that our enemy in this area is Spain, and our most powerful weapon is the freedom hopes of captive peoples now enslaved and peonized under the Spanish. But this weapon alone is not enough. First, we must develop more efficient firearms and artillery. For this task we are depending on our able gunsmiths. We must also bear in mind that there are many different types of weapons. Opium Jones, we would be interested to hear your report. Opium Jones got up and pulled down a map about 6 feet square on a roller, speaking in his dead opium voice. As you know, we have imported a quantity of poppy seed. We already have fields in these areas. Many other areas are suitable for cultivation. We are sending out opium advisors. Missionary work, we call it. And what do you see as the long-range effects of this brotherly project? Asked Nordenhals. In commercial terms, we can undersell Eastern opium and take over the opium trade for the Americas, Canada, and the West Indies. Of course, we can expect a percentage of addicts in the areas of cultivation. What advantages and disadvantages do addicts present from the military point of view? We can ensure loyalty by impounding the opium crop. Addicts are more tolerant than non-addicts of cold, fatigue, and discomfort. They have a strong resistance amounting to virtual immunity to rheums, coughs, consumption, and other respiratory complaints. On the other hand, they are incapacitated if the opium supply is cut off. You also distribute hashish? Certainly. A measure of seed with any purchase at our trading posts. Unlike opium, it grows anywhere. Jones made a sweeping gesture. The whole area is full of it. Dr. Benway got up. Sickness has killed more soldiers than all the wars of history. We can turn illness to account. If your enemy is sick and you are well, the victory is yours. Healthy vultures can kill a sick lion. For example, my learned colleague Opium Jones has pointed out the immunity of addicts to respiratory afflictions. And I may add that periodic users who need not become addicted are equally immune. Consider the advantages conferred in an epidemic of the deadly Spanish influenza. Is there any way in which such an epidemic could be induced? There are no problems. All respiratory complaints are transmitted by spitting, sneezing, and coughing. We need only collect these exudations and convey them into the enemy area. Consider other potential allies. He pointed to areas on the map. Malaria and yellow fever, both imported from the Old World and flourishing in the New. My researches have convinced me that these illnesses are conveyed by mosquitoes. Mosquito netting, pine incense, oil of citronella rubbed on exposed skin areas, these simple precautions not, of course, infallible, will give us an advantage of 50 enemy cases to 1. Dysentery, jaundice, typhoid fever, These even more reliable allies are conveyed by the ingestion of infected excrement, which can be collected and introduced into the enemy water supply. Boiling all drinking water and abstaining from uncooked foods or unpeeled fruits yields 100% immunity. We must, of course, always be careful not to encourage an illness for which we do not have a remedy or means of avoidance. Magical weapons. The Iguana girl spoke in her cool remote voice, "All religions are magical systems competing with other systems. The church has driven magic into covens where practitioners are bound to each other by a common fear. We can unite the Americas into a vast coven of those who live under the Articles, united against the Christian Church, Catholic, and Protestant. It is our policy to encourage the practice of magic and to introduce alternative religious beliefs to break the Christian monopoly. We will set up an alternative calendar with non-Christian holidays. Christianity will then take its place as one of many religions protected from persecution by the Articles." Economic weapons. Strobe glanced through some notes. "We can, of course, undersell Eastern opium, and no doubt various other products such as tea, silk, and spices. But our most powerful monopoly is sugar and rum. Europe will pay our price for sugar." My appetite was sharpened by hashish and I was the better able to savor the excellent repast, clams and oysters baked on hot coals with a dry white wine, wild turkey, pigeons, venison with a vintage Bordeaux, yams, corn, squash, and beans, avocados, mangoes, oranges and coconuts. After the company had eaten their fill, Skipper Nordenhals tapped a glass for silence. He stood up in front of the map, speaking in a self-effacing manner with pauses and unfinished sentences as he gestured from time to time to the map with his long beautifully kept gambler's fingers. For the benefit of newcomers, old hands may also profit, a few indications and guidelines. We have already established fortified settlements, as you see, practically unlimited. We need artisans, soldiers, sailors, and farmers to man the settlements already founded and to establish new centers from the Bering Strait to the Cape. Breeding is encouraged, is in fact a duty, I hope not too unpleasant. We expect that some of you will raise families. In any case, mothers and children, well cared for, you understand. We need families to operate as intelligence agents in areas controlled by the enemy. We solicit those of you who are skilled as cooks, hotel keepers, doctors, and pharmacists, strategic occupations. One of our aims is to addict the Spanish to opium, thereby making them dependent on supplies which we can, at a crucial moment, cut off. And now there are some young ladies who have been waiting to meet you." He sprinkled some powder onto a brazier and a dense cloud of smoke arose with a sound of thunder. Skipper Nordenhals, Captain Strobe, Opium Jones, Dr. Benway, and the Iguana twins disappeared. Now a wind sweeps through the courtyard of Skipper Nordenhall's house at Port Roger, extinguishing the candles. When they are relit, 50 girls and women are standing along the south wall of the courtyard. The men and boys range themselves along the north wall, facing the women. Juanito, the joker and master of ceremonies, prances out to the middle of the courtyard and holds up his hands for silence. "And now we will separate los maridos, the husbands, from los hombres conejos, the rabbit men, who fuck he does a speed up bump and grind and run he does a pantomime of running, swinging his arms and pumping his legs. All rabbit men will move to the east wall." Hans grins and puts his hands to the sides of his head making rabbit ears and trots to the east wall followed by four German friends. A Berber boy with yellow hair, blue eyes, and pointed ears plays the flute as he walks to the east wall. Jerry and the dancing boys hop along behind him chewing carrots. Bert Hansen pulls a rabbit out of a hat, bows, and runs for the east wall to a chorus of boos from the women and applause from the east wall boys. I wriggle my ears and twitch my nose and show my teeth and scamper for the east wall followed by Brady, Paco, Clinch Todd, Guy, and Adam. It's a landslide for the east wall. Juanito looks around as if bewildered. Esperin, Esperin. Wait, wait. He dances behind a screen and pops out naked except for a rabbit mask. He looks at the women. his ears quiver and point east. Y o el mas conejo de los conejos, the rabbitest of the rabbits. He screeches and leaps for the east wall in great hops. He doffs his rabbit mask and advances again to the center of the courtyard and places an hourglass on a little table. He turns to the prospective husbands who still stand by the north wall. You have 2 minutes to think. He goes back to stand by the east wall. As the sand trickles, I study these faces. If we are the fish, they are the water in which we will swim. They will hide us, provide us with weapons, guides, and information. They will carry out missions of sabotage behind enemy lines. Some of them will run ins catering to officials, priests, and generals. Others will become doctors and druggists. They are skilled in the use of subtle drugs and poisons. They will implement Benway's program of germ warfare. A few last-minute rabbits as the sand runs out. Then wives and husbands pair off and retire to private rooms. Juanito leaps up and does a flamenco dance as we move back to the north wall facing the women, of whom 30 remain. They present a wide variety of physical types: blondes, redheads, Indian, Chinese, Negro, Portuguese, Spanish, Malay, Japanese, and some mixed blood. Preparations are underway. The dancing boys whisk away plates and lay down pallets. Incense burners are lit, musical instruments appear, props and costumes are laid out, goat skins of Bujlaud, skeleton suits, wings, animal, and god masks. Two hangman's nooses dangle from a beam, the rope passing through two pulleys to facilitate suspension. I note that the ropes are elastic, and the nooses covered in soft leather. Juanito announces, "Rabbit men and rabbit women, prepare to meet your makers." He leads the way into a locker room opening off the east wall. The boys strip off their clothes, giggling and comparing erections, and they dance out into the courtyard in a naked snake line. The women are also naked now. What follows is not an unconstrained orgy but rather a series of theatrical performances. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now witness the mating of the god Pan and goddess Aisha. A backdrop of Moroccan hills with a full moon lit from behind by a lamp casting a golden glow over our naked bodies as the music of Pan fills the courtyard. Six dancing boys with whips put on goatskin leggings and caps and dance opposite six girls clad in swirling robes of thin blue silk. The faces of the boys are remote and impersonal, yet their bodies quiver and shake as if possessed by wild spirits. The boys rip the robes from Aisha, who tries to flee. They whip her buttocks and she falls on all fours as they fuck her in a crescendo of drums and pipes and a strange perfume fills the air. And now we present for your entertainment, half-hanged Kelly and half-hanged Kate in the gallows fling. Backdrop of a leering crowd. Kate has red hair down to her waist, blazing green eyes, and the raw red hemp marks around her neck. The story is that she was being hanged for witchcraft and other crimes against nature when the officials and spectators were dispersed by banshee whales, whereupon she was cut down and revived by leprechauns. Kate and Kelly take a bow. A sandy-haired boy I have seen on the boat plays the bagpipes as they go into a wild jig, her hair twisting around her like flames from hell, dancing under the waiting nooses which they adjust around each other's necks with idiot grins. He squirms it into her, kicking out spasms in the air, as they are hauled off the ground by smirking hangmen. Now their eyes light up in the gallows flash and the two bodies are encased in a blazing egg of blue-white light. They are lowered to the mat and little boys covered with green paint revive them. They stand up and take a bow. A backdrop of sea and palm trees. Idiot Hawaiian music as Hans does a hula fuck with the lithe Malay girls while his four friends, on their backs, legs in the air, applaud with their feet. Now the palm trees, with boys inside them, go into the hula. The effect is irresistibly comic and there is much laughter. Finally, all the actors, including the palm trees, take a bow. 13 dancing boys fuck to Nawa drums and clappers. Nawa music drives out evil spirits who try to enter the womb. You can see the future child in a rush of liquid gold as the spirit of Hassan I Sabah, master of the jinns, master of the assassins, guides the writhing bodies and wrapped empty faces riding the drums like a bucking horse of flame. All the boys come at once as the wolfish face of Pan blazes in the young faces like a shooting star. The rape of the Valkyrie, announces Juanita. A Swedish girl with long blonde hair is against a backdrop of northern lights. She is riding a horse which suddenly collapses under her and two blonde youths with Viking helmets wriggle out, tying her hands with a gold rope. One fucks her as the other caresses her nipples. The boys grin at each other showing all their teeth. I am trying to figure what sort of act I could put on that would have the necessary concentration of purpose to make a child. Clinch Todd helps me out of my quandary. His father was a veterinarian and he found that sperm collected from a prize pig, horse, bull, dog, or cat could be injected into the vagina resulting in a pregnancy for which the bride must pay a handsome dowry. Furthermore, one milking could provide enough sperm for many little happenings and he had jars of this much stored in the ice house. I made the rounds with him once for kicks. There he is jacking off prize pigs and squirting it into the sow impersonal as if he were trimming a hedge. He had the touch, the animal was randy as soon as he got his hands on it. But he got to using opium and his touch failed him. He was kicked in the head and killed by a stallion. This is the answer. Clinch lines up five girls of different racial stock, black, Chinese, Malay, Indian, Berber, who will be indirectly impregnated, thus sparing me contacts for which I have little inclination. I will play the young corn god with a corn headdress. A boy from Yucatan with black skin, straight hair, and classical Mayan features will stand in as black captain, one of the Mayan war gods, and fuck me standing up, as Jerry, cast as Ganymede the cupbearer, gathers the seed in an alabaster goblet. The girls will proceed to the remote inland communes to await delivery. They will all receive a handsome dowry should they wish to marry, and the children will be trained from childhood in the use of weapons and fitted to take their part in the task of liberation. Pages from the Diary of Hirondelle de Mer. I am a sorceress and a warrior. I do not relish being treated as a breeding animal. Would this occur to Captain Nordenhals? No force, he says, has been applied, but I am forced by my circumstances, cast up here with a peso, and by my Indian blood which compels me to side with all enemies of Spain. The child will be brought up a sorcerer or sorceress. Now, a short rundown on these shabby adventurers plotting to appropriate a continent and remake it to their taste. They all puto queer maricones. Look at that Juanito y el mas marican de los maricones. El mas puto de los putos. Nordenhals was selling his ass in Hamburg 20 years ago. Old story, sea captain takes a liking to him, signs him on as fourth mate. And strobe with his well-rehearsed Eton accent. Circus people. Mother and father were aerialists and they did this high-wire hanging act with angel wings. He takes off the noose, extends his wings, and goes into a dazzling aerial act with his angel wife. It attracted a lot of attentions and the strobes were taken up by the best people, but not for long. Soon the lordliness of their manners, talking to royalty as if they were being nice to the servants, rendered them absolutely insufferable. Their American origins were discovered and they were sent to the colonies, where they decided the angel act was too exotic for American tastes and booked as the singing aerialists. Soon they added other instruments, throwing them from one to another on tightropes, a high-wire musical juggling act it was. Young John learned his poise on the high wire and his swordsmanship as well. But showbiz wasn't for him, and he shipped out with Nordenhals. The Iguana twins have some claim to aristocratic birth. They came from an old landed family, impoverished and dispossessed. They were brought up to act rich at all times, act like you've got it and you'll get it, mother always said. You can't lay it on too thick in Mexico. With preposterous forged titles and pistol arrows on credit, they seized an estate in northern Mexico and hit a silver vein. Nordenhals is a good organizer. He saw at once that a single settlement would inevitably be discovered and wiped out. His plan called for a series of settlements, so that if one were taken they could retreat to another fortified position while bands of 30 men or so cut supply lines, contaminated the enemy water supply, conducted hit-and-run raids, and eventually forced the enemy to fight on two fronts when they laid siege to the next position. Sound strategy. With every victory, more people flocked to the Articles. Suppose the Spanish have been driven out or brought under the Articles. Suppose, too, similar uprisings in North America and Canada have shattered English and French rule. What now? Can this vast territory be held without the usual machinery of government, ambassadors, standing army, and navy? They can only plan to hold the area by sorcery. This is a sorcerer's revolution. I must find my part as a sorceress. Quien es? We flew back with a 3-hour stopover at Orly. I had decided what I was going to do. I was going to refund Mr. Green's retainer, minus travel expenses, and tell him the actual killers were dead in a plane crash. The Greek police consider the case closed. Nothing further I can do. Back in my New York loft I called the Greens. This is Clem Snide calling. I'd like to speak to Mr. Green, please. A woman's voice sounded guarded. What is it in reference to, please? I am a private investigator retained by Mr. Green. Well, I'm afraid you can't speak to him. You see, Mr. and Mrs. Green are dead.
Dead?
Yes. They were killed last night in a car crash. This is Mrs. Green's sister. She sounded pretty cool about it. I'm terribly sorry. I was thinking about what Dimitri had said. The adepts who had hanged Jerry did not know what magical intentions they were projecting. They did not know to whom they were aspeak, plane crash, car crash. I didn't want to think about the Green case anymore, but it stuck to me like the fever smell. What had Dimitri called it? B-23, the hanging fever. Death is enforced separation from the body. Orgasm is identification with the body. So death in the moment of orgasm literally embodies death. It would also yield an earthbound spirit, an incubus dedicated to reproducing that particular form of death. I took a Nembutal and finally slept. Someone was murdered in this room a long time ago. How long ago? The empty safe. The bloody pipe thread here? His partner must have done it. They never caught him. Easy to disappear in those days, when a silver dollar bought a good meal and piece of ass. Smell of dust and old fear in the room. Someone is at the back door. Quien es? The hall is dark. It's Marty come to call, gaslight now on the yellow pockmarked face, the cold gray eyes, the brilliant and black hair, the coat with fur trimming at the collar, the purple waistcoat beneath. We had a hard time finding you. His drunken driver there can hardly stand up. Wore himself out getting here, he did. He made a few stops along the way. Come along to the Metropole and have some bubbly. It's my treat. Now Broadway's full of guys who think they're mighty wise, just because they know a thing or two. No, thanks. What do you mean, no thanks? We had a long way to find you. You can see them every day, strolling up and down Broadway, boasting of the wonders they can do. I'm expecting someone from the palace. Your old pals aren't good enough anymore? Is that it? I don't remember we were exactly pals, Marty. There are con men and drifters, Murphy men and grifters, and they all hang around the Metropole. Let me in, Dalford. I've come a long way. All right, but... But their names would be mud, like a chump playing stud, if they lost that old ace down in the hole. Nice place you got here. Plenty of room. You could put the Metropole in here if it came to that. He is sitting on the bed now. They'll tell you of trip that they're going to take, from Florida up to the old North Pole. Look, Marty. I wake up. Jim is covered with white foam. I can't wake him. Jamie. Jamie. Cold white foam. I wake up. Jim is standing with a pipe threader in his hand, looking towards the back door. I thought someone was in the room. I got up and dressed and went into the kitchen to make breakfast. It tasted disgusting. The Everson questionnaire and picture had arrived, and I looked through them as I drank coffee. The pictures were quite ordinary. The Everson boy looked like the clean-cut American boy. I wondered why he had taken up such an esoteric subject as Mayan archaeology. Jim came in and asked if he could take the day off. He does that occasionally, has an apartment of his own in the East Village. After he left, I sat down and went carefully through the Everson case. The boy had been in Mexico City doing some research in the library preparatory to a dig in Yucatan. In his last letter he said he was leaving for Progreso in a few days and would write from there. After 2 weeks, his family was worried. They waited another week then called the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City. A man checked his address, and the landlady said he had packed and left almost 3 weeks ago. A police check of hotel registration in Progreso turned up nothing. It had now been about 6 weeks with no word. Several possibilities had occurred to me. He may have gone on some alternate dig. Postal service in rural Mexico is practically non-existent. Probably there was no more involved than two or three lost letters. I was inclined to favor some such simply explanation. I had no special feelings about this case and felt sure I could locate young Everson without much difficulty. I decided to knock off and take in a porn flick. It was good, as porn flicks go, beautiful kids on screen, but I couldn't understand why they had so much trouble coming. And all the shots were stylized. Every time a kid came all over a stomach or an ass, he rubbed the jism around like tapioca. I left in the middle of a protracted fuck, and walked down 3rd Avenue to the Tin Palace for a drink. There was a hippie with a ratty black beard at one end of the bar and I could smell Marty on him, that cold gray smell of the time traveler. I'd seen him around before. The name is Howard Benson. Small time publisher, pot and see and occasional olives somewhere in the neighborhood. He caught my eye, drank up and hurried out. I gave him a few seconds start and tailed him to a loft building on Green Street. I waited outside until his light went on, picked the front door lock and went in. I had an identical picture of Marty with me that Jim drew. It looks like a photo. I was going to show it to this Howard and say it was a picture of a murder suspect, and see what I could surprise or bluff out of him. His loft was on the 3rd floor. I knocked loud and long. No answer. I could feel somebody inside. Police. I shouted. Open the door or we'll break it down. Still no answer. Well, that would keep the neighbors out of the hall. It took me about 2 minutes to get the door open. I walked in. There was somebody there, all right. Howard Benson was lying on his face in a pool of blood. The murder weapon was there too, a bloody pipe threader that had smashed in the back of his head. I took a quick look around. There was a filthy pile of bedding in one corner and a phone beside it, some tools, dusty windows, a splintery floor. Benson was lying in front of an old-fashioned safe which was open. A dead gray smell hung in that loft like a fog. Marty was there. The whole scene was like something out of the 1890s. I bent down and sniffed at the open safe. Faint but unmistakable, the fever smell. I got a nail. It stuck to the sides of the safe. The walls were magnetized. Jerry's head had been in that safe. Quickly I drew a circle around the safe, seeing the head as clearly as I could inside. I repeated the words and touched the absent head 3 times with the amulet that Dimitri had given me. A tingle ran up my arm. Half an hour later, I was sitting in O'Brien's office. His boss, Captain Greywood, was also there. Greywood was a tall blonde man with thick glasses and a blank expression. You want the whole story, then? That's the general idea. I told them most of it, what I knew about Marty, and showed them the picture. I told them about Dimitri finding the body and about Adam North's story. Captain Greywood never changed his expression. Once or twice O'Brien turned into his brother, the priest. When I had finished, he took a deep breath. Quite a story, Clem. We've had cases like that, and worse things too, torture, castration, cases that don't get into the papers or into the courts. Captain Greywood said, "So it is your theory that the head was brought here as a potent magical object?"
"Yes."
"And you are convinced that the head was in that safe?"
"Yes."
"And why do you think the body was addressed to South America?"
"I don't know the answer to that."
"Ecuador is headhunter country, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"It is logical to assume then that someone planned to reunite the head and the body in South America."
"I think so."
"You haven't told us everything."
"I've told you what I know."
"This Marty. Dimitri's men never saw him."
"No."
"But you could see him."
"Yes."
"We can't arrest a ghost," said O'Brien. "Well, if he can make himself solid enough to beat someone's brains out with a pipe wrench, you might be able to."
"Question of being there at the right time.
Even the cockroaches.
Una cosa me da risa.
Something makes me laugh.
Pancho Villa sin camisa."
Pancho Villa takes his shirt off. The cucaracha, where Kiki worked as a waiter, had La Cucaracha on the jukebox. It's a basement restaurant, with a small bar and a few tables. It was 11 p.m. and the place was empty. I hadn't seen Kiki since I interviewed him on the Green case. Looking very handsome in a worn dinner jacket, he was leaning against the bar, talking to a bar girl. She does a striptease act uptown on weekends, which is a thing to see. Because old Pancho shakes the dirt out. I shook hands with Kiki, ordered a margarita, and sat down, and right on cue a cockroach crawled across the table. When Kiki brought the margarita, I pointed to the cockroach and said, "He's getting his marijuana and getting it steady."
"S.I.,"
said Kiki absently, and brushed the cockroach away with his towel. I looked around and saw there was one other diner by the door. I hadn't noticed him when I came in. He was sitting alone and reading a book called Thin Air about a top-secret Navy project to make a battleship and all the sailors on it disappear. It was supposed to confuse the enemy, however, all the test sailors went crazy. But CIA men were made of sterner stuff and found it modern and convenient to go zero. As they call it, in a tight spot.
Por qué notion.
Because he doesn't have.
Por qué le falta.
Because he lacks. Marijuana por fumar.
Marijuana to smoke.
On the wall were bullfight posters and the death of Manolete. The poisonous colors made me think of arsenic green and the flaking green paint in the WC. It's a big picture and must be worth a lot of money, like a wooden Indian or Custer's Last Stand, which the Anheuser-Busch Company used to give out to their customers. I remember as an adolescent being excited by the green naked bodies sprawled about ass up, getting scalped by the Indians, and especially a story about one man who played dead while he was being scalped and so escaped. I drank the margaritas and ordered a combination plate and went to the green room. When I came back, Thin Air was gone. Kiki came and sat with me and had a carta blanca. I told him Jerry was dead.
La cucaracha, la cucaracha.
Como?
How?
Ahercado.
Hanged.
Ya no quiere camina.
Doesn't want to run round anymore.
Nudo.
Naked.
S.I.
Yes.
Kiki nodded philosophically and a face leered out, the face of a middle-aged man with a cast in the right eye. This must be Kiki's Macambo magic master, I decided.
It was his destiny, Kiki said.
Look at these. He spread some postcards circa 1913 on the table. The photos showed soldiers hanged from trees and telephone poles with their pants down around their ankles. The pictures were taken from behind.
Pictures get him very hot.
He want me pull scarf tight around his neck when he come.
Kiki made a motion of pulling something around his neck.
Jerry's spirit had got into my assistant.
Only you can call him out.
Why me?
Jerry's spirit has to obey you because you fuck him the best.
Kiki's eyes narrowed with calculation and he drummed on the table with his fingertips. I was thinking I could use an interpreter on this trip, after all, expense account.
My Spanish is half-assed, and in any case he could find out more than two nosy gringos. Like to come along with to Mexico and South America? I named a figure. He smiled and nodded. I wrote the address of my loft on a card and handed it to him. Be there at 11 in the morning. We make magic. When I got back to the loft, Jim was there, and I explained that we were going to perform this ritual to get Jerry's spirit out. He nodded. Yeah, he's half in and half out and it hurts. Next day Kiki showed up with a bundle of herbs and a head of Elijah in a hatbox. As he was setting up his altar, lighting candles and anointing the head, I explained that he would fuck Jim and evoke Jerry to bring Jerry all the way in, and then I had good strong magic to exorcise the spirit. Kiki watched with approval, one magic man to another, as I set up the altar for the noon ritual and lit the incense. It was 10 minutes before noon. Todos nudos ahora. Kiki was wearing red shiny boxer shorts, and when he slipped them off he was half hard. Jim was stiff and lubricating. I drew a circle around our bodies. We were facing south for the noon ritual and I had set up a red candle for fire, which was Jerry's element. The amulet was on the altar and there was a tube of KY by the unguent jar. When I say ahora, fuck him. Kiki picked up the KY and moved behind Jim, who leaned forward over the altar, hands braced on knees. Kiki rubbed KY up Jim's ass and hitched his hand around Jim's hips, contracting his body as his cock slid in. Jim gasped and bared his teeth. His head and neck turned bright red and the cartilage behind his right ear swelled into a pulsing knot. Holding the amulet, I took a position on the other side of the altar. Jerry's face was in front of me now, as the red color spread down Jim's chest and his nipples pulsed erect. His stomach, crotch, and thighs were bright red now, and the rash spread down his calves to his toes and the fever smell reeked out of him. His head twisted to the right as I touched the amulet to the crown of his head, to the forehead between the eyes, and to the cartilage behind both ears. Back to earth. Back to air. Back to fire. Back to water. For a split second Jerry's face hung there, eyes blazing green light. A reek of decay filled the room. Someone said shit in a loud voice. We carried Jim to a couch. Kiki got a wet towel and rubbed his chest, face, and neck. He opened his eyes, sat up, and smiled. The decay smell was gone. So was the fever smell. At 2 o'clock O'Brien called, "Well, I think we've found your head for you or what's left of it. Can't be sure until we check the dental work. Where did you find it?" "At the airport. Crate labeled machine parts sent by air freight and addressed to a broker in Lima, Peru, to be picked up by Juan Mateus. The crate was being loaded onto the plane when the workman accidentally dropped it and it split open. It was airtight and strongly built, it just happened to fall right on a seam. They tell me the stink was enough to knock a man down. One of puked all over the crate." "When did this happen?" "At noon. We sent along a duplicate crate and contacted the Lima police to tail anyone who calls for it." "Was the crate lined with magnetized iron?" "Yes. We duplicated that too. The Lima police have two men planted in the customs brokers to watch anyone who calls for other crates in case he tries to check out the head crate in any way. A compass would tell him it is magnetized. We've got a wax head inside, so even with X-ray equipment." "Very good. You seem to have thought of everything. But just one more point, an object like that gives out very strong psychic vibrations that a sensitive could pick up on. You might tell them to watch, especially for an adolescent who comes for another crate and touches or brushes up against the head crate. That's already been done. Captain Greywood told them to watch for an errand boy who might brush against the crate, especially with his ass or crotch." O'Brien said this in a matter-of-fact voice, as if it were routine procedure. Dimitri, Greywood, and now O'Brien. Who the hell were these so-called cops? Firecrackers. There are about 30 boys staying in Skipper Nordenhall's palace, as we call it. The number fluctuates from day to day as people come in from other settlements or set out on various missions. Mr. Thomas has taken the Great White and sailed with a small crew. His assignment is, as always, to recruit people with special skills. The boys cook in the communal kitchen or on the patio. Here the Arab boys roast meat over charcoal fires and bake bread in clay ovens. Food is plentiful. We set traps for fish in the river and in the bay. A short walk into the jungle and I can shoot wild turkey and grouse and occasionally a deer. River fish can also be kept in the fish pond until needed. We are all up at dawn for a breakfast of eggs, fruit, and bread. Then after a short rest there is instruction in bare hand fighting given by Japanese and Chinese youths, the use of stick, chain, and staff, different styles of swordsmanship, and knife fighting. An Indian thuggee gives lessons in the strangling cord. He belongs to a dissident magical brotherhood known as the Secret Stranglers who have separated themselves from the worship of Kali. I take particular interest in archery since the bow can deliver more projectiles in less time than the guns we are making. I have made a number of crossbows to sell in the store so that the Indians will be able to duplicate the design. These bows are not as heavy as the usual crossbows and it is quite easy to pull and cock the bow by hand. I am more interested in speed of fire than in armor-piercing strength. Dink Rivers excels at the martial arts. After a few lessons he is able to equal his instructors in proficiency. He explains once general body control is mastered, any physical skill can be learned almost at once. He has promised to show me the secrets of body control but says that the time has not yet come. I get my orders in dreams and whatever happens in my dreams then has to happen when I wake up. Often he does not sleep in the palace and Hans tells me he has a hut about half a mile down the coast. One night I dream I am sitting with Dink when he looks at me and says, I think you should see this, pulling down his shorts to reveal his half-erect phallus. I wake up in a state of great excitement and Dink says that the time is approaching. In preparation I must abstain from sex for 3 days. At the end of this period, during which I had not seen him, B appeared in my room during the siesta hour and led the way out through the gate and along the path by the sea. We are quite close to the hut before I can see it, built in clump of trees and shrubs, painted green and blending with the surroundings. The house is built of parts salvaged from grounded ships. Inside it is cool and dark, smelling of pitch. The house consists of a single room furnished like a ship's cabin, containing a chest, a rolled-up pallet, and two low stools of driftwood. We take off our clothes, hanging them on wooden pegs and he indicated that I am to sit opposite him on one of the stools, our knees touching. He looks silently into my eyes and I feel a tightness and weakness in the chest. He is getting stiff and so am I, the feeling of weakness now like death in the throat as we both are fully erect. Silver spots boil in front of my eyes and I have a feeling of squeezing into his nuts and cock as I lie on the pallet and Dink fucks me. Afterwards we lie down side by side. He is talking in his clear grave young voice. I have rarely seen him smile and there is something very sad and remote about him like a faint sign or signal from a distant star. Middletown isn't like the town where you came from. There are no MRS. Norton's sniffing around for the scent of whiskey and sin. We do not allow people like her in Middletown. To an outsider, Middletown is just a pretty little place, stone houses along a clear river. Nice friendly folk. But strangers don't stay unless we can adjust them to our ways. For those who must remain outside there is no land for sale and no work. Middletown is run by a magical brotherhood. You will hear about white and black lodges, the right-hand path and the left-hand path. Believe me, there is no such sharp line. However, the Middletown brothers would not allow themselves to be placed in a position where they would need to use the usual methods of black magic. Once you achieve body control, you don't need that. There is no formal initiation into the brotherhood. Initiation comes through dream guides. At the age of 14, when I began to have dreams that culminated in ejaculation, I decided to learn control of the sexual energy. If I could achieve orgasm at will in the waking state, I could do the same in dreams and control my dreams instead of being controlled by them. To accomplish sexual control, I abstained from masturbation. In order to achieve orgasm, it is simply necessary to relieve a previous orgasm. So while awake, I would endeavor to project myself into sexual dreams, which I was now having several times a week. It was some months before I acquired sufficient concentration to get results. One day I was lying naked on my bed, feeling a warm spring wind on my body and watching leaf shadows dance on the wall. I ran through a sex dream like reciting my ABCs when suddenly silver spots boiled in front of my eyes and I experienced a feeling of weakness in the chest, the dying feeling, and I am slipping into myself in the dream and go off. Having brought sexual energy under control, I now had the key to body control. Errors, fumbles, and ineptitudes are caused by uncontrolled sexual energy, which then lays one open to any sort of psychic or physical attack. I went on to bring speech under control, to be used when I wanted, not yammering in my ear at all times or twisting tunes and jingles in my brain. I used the same method of projecting myself into a time when my mind seemed empty of words. This I would do while walking in the woods or paddling on the lake. Once again, I waited some time for results. One day as I was paddling on the lake and about to put out fish lines, I felt the weakness in my chest. Silver spots appeared in front of my eyes with a vertiginous sensation of being sucked into a vast empty space where words do not exist. Asterisk. My time is divided between the library and the gun shop. The library is well stocked with books on weapons, fortifications, shipbuilding, and navigation, and has also a large number of maps indicating the number of Spanish troops stationed in different locations, the nature of fortification, and the Spanish sea routes with approximate times when they are in use. It often happens that quite practical inventions are for some reason not developed. Here are plans for a repeating gun with a number of barrels rotating by means of a hand-turned crank. A repeating gun is one of my dreams, but first there is some basic improvement required in the gun itself. Hans and I, wearing only shorts, are reading the same book, our knees touching. Here are plans for a grenade, simply a metal sphere filled with powder ignited by a fuse, and a mortar that shoots large grenades for a considerable distance. I feel a sudden quickening of interest and a prickling sensation in the back of my neck. Hans seems equally affected. He is breathing through his teeth, eyes boring into the paper as if he were studying an erotic drawing. We look at each other and stand up, our shorts sticking out at the crotch. We strip our shorts and Hans grins and brings his finger up in three jerks. I prop the book against the wall on the far side of the desk and bend over a chair. As Hans fucks me, the drawings seem to come alive, belching red fire, and just as I go off, Chinese children set off a string of firecrackers against the door and I see a huge firecracker blow the library to atoms as a gob of sperm hits the book 6 feet away. We sit down naked and Hans wipes his brow with one hand and says, "We owe." I say, "Firecracker. That's the basic exploding weapon. It's all here, but they didn't see how far it can be carried. Firecrackers, they can be of any size. Why not exploding cannonballs? One such projectile could sink a galleon. Waring is expecting us." Dink leads the way up a steep path. Waring's house is on top of a hill in grove of trees, concealed by vines. He receives us most cordially in a cool room furnished in the Moroccan style with a low table and sets. A tall aloof black serves mint tea, and Waring passes around a hashish pipe. Dink declines, since he never touches alcohol or any other drug. At a sign from Dink, Waring gets up and leads us into his studio. While there is still light, his paintings are unlike any I have ever seen, containing not one but many scenes, figures, and landscapes that flicker in and out of the canvas. I can see the great white harbor point, fleeting faces, islands, flying fish, and Indians rowing across the bay. Back in the sitting room, candles have been lit, and there is a partridge pie with flaky pastry and wild turkey tajin on a low table. I do not remember much of what was said during dinner. At one point, Waring looked at me quizzically and said, "What you are doing is against the rules. Be careful you don't get caught." It was quite late when we left. Back in the hut, Dink rolled out the pallet and I fell into a deep sleep. In a dream I see Dink standing over me with the most perfectly formed erect phallus I have ever seen. Now he is fucking me with my legs up, and as I wake up ejaculating, I find that he is fucking me. I can feel his face in mine, and for a split second he disappears and I hear his 14-year-old voice in my throat, "It's me. It's me. It's me. I made it. I landed." We can hardly wait to get back to the shop and set all hand to work. In a week, we have several different devices ready for testing. I have made a number of arrows, the heads of hollow iron filled with powder, grenades, with a shaft to be launched from a flintlock rifle, several mortars, and a projectile for a cannon, designed to explode on contact. The nose of this projectile, which is not round but shaped like a short cylinder, is of softer metal packed with flint chips and iron filings so that, being violently depressed on contact with ship or rigging, it explodes the powder charge. Inside, the cylinder is lined with Greek fire, that is, pitch mixed with finely powdered metal, this being separated from the powder charge by a layer of paper. The time is now ready for testing. There is a stranded ship 200 yards off the coast, a mile down from our station. We proceed to the testing site with our bows and rifle grenades, mortars, and one cannon. Everyone is there: Strobe, the Iguana twins, Nordenhals, even Waring. 10 arrows and 10 rifle grenades are dipped into the fire. Bow is drawn, the head ignited from a torch, and the arrow launched, the same procedure being followed with the rifle grenades, which are of course much larger. The missiles streak towards the ship and in a few seconds are exploding on the decks, in the rigging, and against the sides, starting fires from one end of the boat to the other. Then mortars are launched, and though some fall short or overshoot, those that land cause great damage. Time now for the cannon, a perfect hit with a 10-pound projectile at the waterline. The explosion tears a gaping hole in the hull and wraps the boat side in fire. There is no doubt as to the deadly effectiveness of these weapons. We are congratulated by Nordenhals and Strobe and the Iguana twins. Waring smiles and says, "Nice toys. Nice noisy toys to scare the ghosts away." The plans are sent along by courier to the other settlements and we busy ourselves bringing the fortifications of Port Roger up to date. The Indians are offered good pay to work in our ever-expanding shop and are learning how to make these devices. Soon we have a fair stockpile of shells sufficient to pour a deadly fire into the bay from both sides. We have mounted gun towers around the walls of the town with cannon that can reach the bay or be lowered to fire directly down on any forces laying siege to Port Roger. Nordenhals is supervising the construction of special boats designed to operate near the coasts. These are about 50 feet long, mounted on two pontoons. They will draw only a few feet of water and can be used in rivers and quickly launched or concealed. They will carry the maneuverable cannons and a good stock of mortars and grenades. He calls them destroyers, since they have no other purpose. No provisions need be carried, just guns and gun crews, and the destroyers will be so much faster than a galleon that they can easily avoid the fixed cannons. I now turn my attention to improving the flintlock. My dissatisfaction with this weapon derives from an incident that occurred in a waterfront tavern in Boston. This place was near our old gun shop, and we were accustomed to take a beer there after work. One evening I was there with Sean Brady when a man came in who had been dismissed by my father for his drunken, lazy, quarrelsome habits and had stomped out, vowing vengeance on all of us. There he stood at the bar, weaving and glaring at us with bloodshot eyes, and let loose a string of vile oaths and insults. Brady told him to mind his mouth or lose his teeth, whereupon the man pulled a flintlock pistol from his side pocket, leveled it at Brady's chest, and pulled the trigger. At this precise second the bartender, who was standing behind the ruffian and to one side, spat a stream of beer straight into the pen, causing the weapon to misfire. We then beat the man unconscious and threw him into the harbor and watched him sink. Of what use are flintlock weapons with a driving rain behind you? And the length of time taken to reload far exceeds the firing time. The weapon lacks firing power, that is, the number of projectiles that can be fired in a given length of time. So back to the library. I note that early cannonballs were breech loading, and feel once again the admonitory PRIC cling in the back of my neck. At that very moment a hand touches the nape of my neck. It is the iguana who has come in silently with her twin. I look up at her. It's there in my head, but I can't quite get it out where I can see it. Well, how did you see the exploding cannonball? Hans and I look at each other and grin. Waring has told me about Hassan Isabah, the old man of the mountain, who terrorized the Muslim world for years with a few hundred assassins. I pointed out that holding a single fortified position as Hassan Isabah did at Alamut is no longer possible, owing to improved weapons that I have already perfected and which will inevitably, in the course of time, fall into the hands of our prospective enemies. We need now a much wider area of occupation, Waring said cryptically. Well, that depends on what you are trying to do. As I was returning from the library this afternoon, a red-haired child of 12 or so popped out of a doorway, aimed a small pistol at me and pulled the trigger. Bang! You're dead. I had seen these toy pistols many times before and never concerned myself to find out exactly how they functioned, just as I had seen firecrackers without realizing the potentials of that toy. The child was reloading. Let me see that, I demanded. The child handed me his pistol, which had a flat hammer. The report resulted from the hammer's striking a little blister of powder glued between two pieces of paper. Suddenly I had the solution, firing device, charge, and ball in one unit, to be inserted and extracted through the breech. I bent down and the boy jumped up on my back, and I carried him into the gun shop as he fired his pistol in the air. We are working round the clock on this design. Pallets are on the floor, and we take turns sleeping. We are producing double-barreled guns in both rifle and pistol form, for increased firepower. In a week we have two rifles and two pistols, with a number of cartridges ready for testing. The test is carried out in the gun shop, since secrecy must be observed. A man-sized target is set up at 100 feet. Pow pow, two bullets on target. After the test I present the red-headed boy, whose name is Chan, with a rifle and give Strobe a pistol. At this Strobe is somewhat piqued. I retain the remaining two weapons for my own use. Plans are immediately dispatched by courier to all the settlements in these locations, on the Pacific side of the Isthmus of Panama opposite the Pearl Islands, two settlements inland from Guayaquil in a heavily wooded and mountainous area, and settlements above Panama City on both the Atlantic and Pacific sides and in the mountainous interior. Production of the weapons is now standardized and we have 50 Indians working under our supervision. As soon as they learn how to assemble the guns, they are sent back to their villages and jungles, since decentralization is a keynote of our strategy. Instead of one central factory, there are a number of small shops that can turn out a few guns a day. We are distributing guns through the store in Port Roger. Arming the native population is another essential step. The cannon that protect Port Roger are being converted to receive breech-loading shells. Necesita automobile. I hadn't been in Mexico City in 15 years. Driving in from the airport I could hardly recognize the place. As Dimitri said, a selective pestilence may be the only solution. Otherwise, they will multiply their assholes into the polluted seas. Kiki, Jim, and I checked into a small hotel off Insurgents, which was a few blocks from John Everson's Mexico City address. Then we split up. Jim and Kiki went to John Everson's address to see what they could pick up from the landlady and the vecinos. I went to the American Embassy, found the Protection Department, and sent in my card. I saw the girl hand it to a man at a desk. He looked at the card and looked at me. Then he did something else. I waited 20 minutes. Mr. Hill will see you now. Mr. Hill didn't get up or offer to shake hands. Yes, Mr. He glanced down at the card. Snide. What can I do for you? There is a breed of State Department official who starts figuring out how he can get rid of you without doing whatever it is you want done as soon as you walk into his department. Clearly, Mr. Hill belonged to this breed. It's about John Everson. he disappeared in Mexico City about 2 months ago. His father has retained me to locate him. Well, we are not a missing person service. So far as we are concerned, the case is now with the Mexican authorities. I suggest you contact them.